Welcome to this week's Investors Chronicle Personal Finance Podcast. I'm Lenora Walters, and joining me today are Taha Lokhandwala, Deputy Personal Finance Editor, Investors Chronicle, and Tim Stubbs, Independent Investment Consultant at TS Investments. Emerging markets have not traditionally been thought of as a good source of income, but there are a few funds focused on these regions that do have an attractive yield, and these include Utilico Emerging Markets Trust. Taha, what level of yield does this trust offer?
I don't know. So the trust offers a yield of 3.3%, which is, as you said, quite unusual for an emerging market kind of strategy. It's often thought of to be very growth focused and not very income. The companies are quite new compared to ones you see in developed market. But when you look at the underlying stocks in this trust, it kind of makes a bit more sense.
Okay, so if emerging markets aren't particularly associated with income, how does Utilico Emerging Markets Trust's manager manage to generate this attractive yield?
Charles Gilling, the manager, he doesn't actually do anything to maintain the yield. He even advocates in saying this isn't a dedicated income trust. He jokes about people talking about wanting to rename the trust to income, but it's not the focus. But what it does do is buy very cash generative businesses, and these are normally utility companies or infrastructure stocks. So these companies have really kind of high fixed costs, but once those fixed costs are taken care of, they are just entirely cash generative and therefore really good income stocks.
Okay, sounds interesting. So what would be an example of one of these cash generative businesses?
So the one Mr. Gilling talks about quite a lot is Shanghai Airport. So Shanghai is obviously a huge Chinese city, but it's actually growing at a higher rate than the Chinese average. And Mr. Gilling talks about the kind of the middle class, the Chinese middle class that you have in Shanghai. They have a lot more disposable income, and air travel is one of the things that they're kind of focused on. So Shanghai Airport is growing, and therefore its revenue is growing, and therefore its dividend is growing as well.
Okay. What other types of infrastructure does the trust invest in?
Almost everything you can think of. So it has kind of exposure to water, to sewage, electricity. Electricity actually accounts for 24% of the trust, and gas works accounts for about 17%. So kind of the staple kind of infrastructure and kind of utility stocks that you would expect.
Now, you mentioned obviously the trust has a holding in China, but it invests across emerging markets. So what other particular areas does Charles Gilling's like?
So he's a big fan of Brazil, although he will definitely state this isn't a kind of macro position. They are bottom-up stock pickers, but they have just found lots of opportunities in Brazil, which accounts for about 23% of the fund. Romania, which is, again, not something you would expect to appear quite a lot, actually accounts for 10% of the fund. And so Brazil, there's a few kind of fundamental reasons. So, yeah, as I said, it is the companies, but also it's kind of come out of a bit of an economic turmoil, and it's doing quite well at the moment.
Okay, so what would be an example of a Brazilian holding in Utilico Emerging Markets Trust?
So he's got quite an interesting one called Rumo. And what Rumo does is it's a rail logistics firm. So what he does, it transports goods across Brazil via the rail network. Mr. Gilling tells a quite interesting anecdote where he talks about Brazilian car traffic being so heavy, so it's impossible to use the road network to transport goods. So he thinks that there's a good opportunity for Rumo to keep growing its revenues here. Brazil's a big exporter of certain things like soya, and they transport quite a lot of soya across Brazil to the ports, and it gets shipped out to places like China, actually.
So looking good in Brazil. But what does Charles Gilling think of the prospects for emerging markets more widely?
Naturally, he's quite bullish, but he accepts there's some risks. So you see kind of political interference from Donald Trump. Trade wars is a word we're hearing more and more, and he's kind of conscious of these. And you've got, he has exposure in the Middle East, and the Middle East is politically sensitive, and no one really knows what's going to happen there. But he stresses that you need to look towards the fundamentals. So the economic growth, particularly in the regions he's heavily exposed to, like China and Brazil, is still, is relatively strong. Also, inflation is quite benign, interest rates quite benign. So he thinks there's a good foundation, particularly for these kind of infrastructure and utility stocks that are more likely to kind of do well in these environments.
Okay, so he's fairly optimistic.
Absolutely.
But Tim, what do you think of the prospects for emerging markets, and are they a good area to invest in just now?
Yes, I think on a medium to long term view, emerging markets should seem to be priced to provide strong returns going forwards. There are, as you'd expect, cheaper areas of the market, and many traditional value stocks look to be particularly cheap and to offer particularly strong returns on that kind of medium to long-term view. I'd say that the tech area of the market, which now things like Tencent, Alibaba, Baidu, which now represents over a quarter of the emerging markets benchmark index, perhaps is something of a bubble. So that's one area from an investment perspective I'd be very light on. So, I think the long-term prospects look to be quite good, especially on the back of 5 years in doldrums before the pickup of 2016 and 17. Are they a good area to invest in just now? I think now there are some shorter-term risks we've seen in the last week or so, not least the dollar's rallied, and we've seen that some self-inflicted problems in Argentina and Turkey have led to those two nations in particular seeing their currencies sell off. Albeit, of course, they are weaker, let's say weaker, structurally weaker emerging market countries with less good fundamentals. So you'll always see differences between them. So I was going to say that in the short term, perhaps there could be some slight risks. So I'd say that, you know, in the long term, I think it should be good. So if there's any kind of, if any investors have any doubt about the shorter term, they can always dip a toe in and with a view to potentially buying a lot more on a meaningful correction, let's say.
Okay, so I mean that's the big picture, but turning back to income, do you agree that emerging markets are a good source of equity income?
As a generalisation, I think it's not the primary reason one should seek to invest in emerging markets. Granted, I know that the Utilico Trust is seeking infrastructure type assets generating cash flow, so it's a little bit different. But as a generalisation, I think if you chase too much yield in the emerging markets sector, you'll end up with, let's say, less dynamic, more mature companies, some state-owned companies, state-owned enterprises, that is. So really, the name emerging markets, by definition, you're looking for countries and companies that can grow very significantly in the medium and longer term, especially. So I think you really want to have a focus on companies that can reinvest their earnings into growth. But equally, you know, there are some good income stocks out there, and there is a reasonable blend. You can achieve there is a kind of good compromise in the middle there. I'd say the primary aim should be longer term growth, but I certainly think an investor could do a lot worse than have a small little allocation to receive some income, albeit I wouldn't necessarily chase too high a yield per se.
Okay, so with that in mind, I mean, what kind of income can you sensibly get from emerging markets, and how does that compare to what you might be able to get from other parts of the world?
Well, the MSCI emerging markets benchmark is yielding 2.3% last time I checked, very recently. So that's not a bad starting point, but you can immediately see that that's well below the 3-3.5% in Europe, let's say, and 4% in the UK. So naturally, the yields offered, the starting point is lower. So that has to be borne in mind as per the bigger picture theme of long-term growth. You'd expect that. But I'd say, as well as considering emerging market income versus other regions of the world, I'd say you also have to always be aware that emerging markets carry notable risks. So even if you do find some an attractive portfolio, good valuations, quite cheap, if anything causes a run on emerging market currencies or capital flows or any usual classic stock market sentiment change, there's nothing to stop cheap, attractive stocks getting very cheap and attractive. So that's just another thing the income investor has to bear in mind. Final point I just realised, is that with levels of corporate governance generally weaker, I guess a dividend in a developed country is perhaps more stable, whereas in emerging markets it could be removed, let's say, far more easily than it could be in a developed country.
Okay, now you mentioned lower levels of corporate governance. What are the other risks you hinted at when you were talking about things for people to consider?
Yeah, well, as mentioned, I'd certainly say emerging market stocks are not really so suitable for low-risk investors. And even investors of a medium risk profile, let's say, would want to have a very slight participation. Yes, so we said corporate governance and companies that are not always run for the interests of shareholders, or, say, governments influencing and so on. These are things that can obviously throw up surprises and sometimes will lead investors to sell off such stocks. It's a way up, of course. Sometimes you can find such things at cheaper valuations. Another, I guess, risk is that, I suppose, in the near term, seeing the strong performance of the last 2 years, if there's any kind of reversal in momentum, let's say, like ETF flows have led lots of money into the tech areas. There are kind of shorter-term vulnerabilities as well, potentially. I think we've probably covered most of the main risks in those, that little list there, I think.
Okay. Now, if you do have, let's say, the risk appetite and time horizon to invest in emerging markets, what funds would you suggest?
Well, if you're looking for some income from emerging markets, I think the Somerset Emerging Markets Dividend Growth Fund, run by Edward Lam, is a very, very well-run, defensive, safe pair of hands funds, if you like. It yields 2.7% at the underlying level, the companies within the portfolio. And as the name suggests, the manager seeks to find a blend of companies that have a reasonable yield already and others that will grow dividends or expected to grow dividends over time, companies that are expected to perform well. The attraction to me of that fund is it's very light in China and tech in particular. The manager's shown an excellent downside protection versus upside capture, so he's able to generally participate in much of the upside, yet in the downside period he's generally protected against losses. He's a very conservative chap, so I think that's a good one for somebody looking for some yield. It's not the highest yield, but that's a good one to slot in, I think. And if somebody were looking for more of a value slant, let's say in a kind of index base, let's say closer to an index-based approach, there are three funds that I think are particularly good. I think the Artemis Global Emerging Markets Fund uses a quant methodology to screen and has roughly 100 stocks. The 7IM Emerging Value Fund does something similar. And also the Henderson Rowe Raffi Emerging Markets Index Fund. It is a fund, but it seeks to track the research affiliates' fundamental index in emerging market space, which is a benchmark that's been designed to improve upon the classic limitations of market cap-weighted benchmarks. That is, the largest, most expensive stocks taking up the biggest portion of your allocation in your fund, whereas this fund seeks to dilute those down and have tilt towards companies offering dividends and cheapest share prices based on the book values and P/E ratio and so on. Those are four that I think are quite good candidates.
Okay, Tim, thank you. Some really helpful suggestions. And you can see the full interview with the Twilico Emerging Market Trust's manager in this week's issue of Investors Chronicle and on the website. This week's Portfolio Clinic features a couple who are planning to do what loads of us would love to do but probably can't afford, retire early. The couple have built up a tremendous amount of assets, so look like they'll be able to do it. But a very high proportion of their wealth is related to their employer, which they both work for. Tim, you reviewed this portfolio. Why do these readers have high exposure to their employer, and why do you think it's not a good idea?
Yes, so the readers in your portfolio, they received share options, is my understanding, effectively from working for their companies, part of their remuneration. In over recent years, they've been awarded shares which have now grown notably in value to roughly £500,000 between the two of them out of a 1.2 million combined portfolio, which is naturally, you know, half the money there. They also had pensions that are provided by their employer, but I'm less concerned about those given general protection schemes in the event of defined benefit schemes going under. The reason why I think that position is not a good idea is just that you can see that virtually half of their wealth and even their employment and even their pension is tied to the prospects of one single company. And if we just look at the ultimate worst case and that company goes bust, then £500,000 is down the drain. They've probably lost their jobs. Maybe their pensions are kind of shaved in value. And this is when you've got 5 years till retirement. I know that's a very extreme case. So it's just something to consider. A lot of very high concentration of risk. But I mean, the idea is not bad in itself of receiving share options. I just wonder whether over time it may be possible or may not. They may wish to dilute some of those, sell them effectively and invest across their wider portfolio instead, having greater diversification.
Okay, so, I mean, in general then, do you think people should turn down attractive benefits such as a pension scheme and shares in an employer to avoid having too much exposure to the company they work for?
I don't think they should necessarily turn anything down at all. I mean, if something's offered to you, it's valuable. I guess the question is, in my opinion, the size of these shares are just so large now relative to their total wealth. I would seek to ask the employer if they can instead receive, let's say, higher salaries or greater pension contributions, if that's still appropriate based on annual limits and lifetime allowances and so on. It's a case, really, of whether the employer can offer them the chance to still receive the same level of remuneration. Granted, it's something where companies might offer share options so they don't have to pay out. So it might be a case of if a company offers you that and it's very generous and they're not prepared to offer anything nearly as generous in cash, let's say, it might be that the best answer is to take that because you're better off. But then you just really need to plan accordingly that if effectively half a million of your wealth is tied up in this one company, you may not be able to sell it, let's say, you just really need to take account of that with the remainder of your portfolio. The big risk would be as if you're just overstretched to risk assets.
Okay. So looking at the example of Reuters and this week's portfolio, what might they be able to do to reduce their exposure to their employer?
Yeah, I mean, in theory, they could consider selling a large portion of those shares just so they're not so exposed. I say in theory because it depends on the arrangements in place with their employer. I'm no expert on this topic, but my general thoughts could be maybe employers will say, while you're working for us, you can have the stake, but maybe, if there might be penalisation if you choose to cash in the stake or if you choose to leave the company or anything like this. So it's a case of, in theory, selling down the stake would be the best thing to do for diversification. But there might be side effects of loss of some of that value, and also there would likely be notable tax effects. So it could be quite a complicated picture where they'd really need to map out, you know, scenario one, this would be the outcome, scenario two, and they'd really need the help of a financial planner and a specialist to go through all those scenarios, if they're even available, that is.
Yeah, okay, so a number of things to take into consideration in this situation.
Yes.
Now, other than their employer pensions and shares, these readers hold a number of funds, but all of these funds are listed. Is this a good idea to be entirely in listed funds?
Yes, so investment trusts in the long run do tend to outperform, and that is because, well, amongst other things, gearing adds an extra dimension of drive forwards. Costs can be a bit lower.
In some cases, can be a lot more, I'd say, in investment trusts. Mm. Some investment trusts are very expensive, but
it's true. Mm. Yep. It depends, I guess, on what they are. Mm. But I guess some equity based vehicles can be on the economical side. I suppose it's like anything.
Esoteric ones tend to have very high charges, though.
Yes, exactly. They need more specialist management and higher cost to do so, really. But I think generally I would be less inclined to have an entire portfolio of investment trusts. And the reason is, despite maybe outperforming in the long run, part of the issue is the swings can be very large. So you can find that a simple generalization is that throughout a stock market cycle of a market crash to a market peak, you'll find that at the peaks, you'll find that these investment trusts will be trading at either very small discounts to NAV or even premiums. And then in crisis moments, not only will the NAV fall heavily, but then the trust can also go to a notable discount, say 20, 30% to NAV in extreme cases, as happened in the financial crisis. Private equity trusts were even some 80% or more. Mm. So the issue really is if you hold your entire portfolio investment trust, you really could face an immense double whammy, you know, negative scenario. It all depends on the investor. If they're comfortable to just sit on that and ride it all the way through, then that's fine. But your reader here is retiring in 5 years, so I would suggest maybe a blend of listed investment trusts, if that's what they're comfortable with and can handle it and understand it, and some open-ended investment company funds instead.
On that note, even with an investment trust, even if the underlying asset's doing well, like you said, the share prices can have massive fluctuations due to market sentiment. So would you say that investment trusts focused on alternative assets provide any meaningful diversification, or because they are listed, will they just move of equity markets even if invested, let's say, in non-correlated assets?
It really depends what they are. I would say in general, more than not would likely move with equity markets. Not always the case, though, and it depends on the reputation of the trust in question, and also liquidity is a critical factor. I mean, many investment trusts are less liquid, and if suddenly huge rushes for the exits, then that's ultimately what causes these price swings. And that will come at the same time as equities, because that's when people are just generally trying to offload anything they can, irrespective of what it is, and irrespective of that, it might be diversified. If someone's a forced seller, they have to try to sell something. But then, in theory, the alternative assets that are unconnected should, in theory, have better qualities and be more likely to stand up. And actually, if such assets were to fall down, at least on a share price level, that would be a very good opportunity if the underlying is actually not so connected to fortunes there. I'd say it also depends on the reputation of the trust. I mean, trusts like Ruffer Investment Company, Personal Assets Trust, Capital Gearing Trust are known for being very defensive-minded capital preservation type vehicles. The managers really, really don't want to lose money. And because of that and their large following, those trusts sometimes can actually move to a premium in moments of stress. So it all depends. It depends on liquidity. It depends on the individual trust and its own liquidity and what it does. But I think, yes, I think the full extent of diversification might not be there, but it will depend on each cycle, if you like, each. But equally, if something like that happens, it presents an opportunity too. So there are two sides to the coin.
Okay. So how else would you suggest diversifying a portfolio's equity exposure?
Yes, I mean, I think one very notable observation of the last 10 years is that value investing has really struggled. Perhaps it's not surprising following the crisis. People were looking for very defensive stocks, reliable, classic bond proxy growth stocks, things like Unilever. Everybody has to wash their clothes and buy toothpaste and so on. And so everybody flocked to these reliable, defensive stocks, and the valuations have been bid up. And actually some numbers from Schroders, who invest more in a value style, have indicated that they believe that over 2,500 global equity funds, they thought that 93% were actually in the growth style. So everybody chasing those safer stories, if you like. And also what's been comfortable. You know, it's been a very horrible place to be if you're a value investor, through underperforming and continually. So there's a human psychology element there too. So I would say that you certainly don't want to be too skewed to one particular style that's worked very well in a phase of falling interest rates. So I think diversification by style, I certainly think there's room for a little bit of value exposure in a portfolio.
What about diversifying away from equities, though? I mean, what about alternative assets to diversify? Any you'd suggest? Non-equity assets.
Definitely. I mean, I certainly think an investment portfolio should consist of lots of asset classes that are, let's say, more modern, if you like, compared to the traditional equity and bonds portfolio. Things like absolute return, hedge funds, like I said, trusts like Ruffer, Personal Assets, Capital Gearing Trust are focused on capital preservation. There's certainly many things investors can do to move away from equities, or at least have managers that are really focused on the capital preservation element. Of course, Taha said the Utilico Investment Trust that focuses on infrastructure assets, another semi-source of diversification in that specific asset types are targeted, infrastructure in this case. Commodities as well is a timely example, with oil prices rising up to $80. So certainly there are things you can do to diversify away, and you can also consider what things would actually hurt your portfolio, what would hurt a classic portfolio. And for example, rising interest rates. If interest rates were to rise notably, that would clearly hurt bonds mathematically, and it would most likely hurt equities too, depending on the exact reason. So you can certainly look for ways to profit from things that might benefit in such a scenario. Let's say like financials would benefit from rising interest rates, other things equal. Commodities, if there's rising inflation, and let's say that causes higher interest rates, then on average you might see commodity based equities expected to do better. So you can't fully escape the equity risk. You can certainly control the proportion, and you can spread out the exposures quite widely amongst different types is what I would suggest.
Okay. Now, another issue you raised with these readers' portfolio is a lack of exposure to UK equities. Why is this a problem?
Yeah, it's not so much of a problem, but more of a potential missed opportunity. It goes without saying that Brexit, the scaremongering, the headlines, the risks hanging over have led UK stocks to perform quite poorly on the global stage in recent years. Despite the all-time high reached yesterday. So what it means is that the UK stocks are trading a bit more cheaply than other global developed market regions, when in all essence, let's say certainly on a FTSE 100 level, they're global multinationals. So there should really be little reason to have a discount, let's say, on a multinational firm, unless you were really expecting severe changes at a country level, like massive corporate tax increases or anything like that. So really, I think it's just a classic case of there's an opportunity to, the valuations there are suggesting that some decent returns could be generated on, say, a five-year view, 10-year view. So it's really just a case of it looks like a good opportunity where the client, the reader's a little bit light in their portfolio, perhaps.
Okay. Now, you mentioned Brexit. So, you know, have they perhaps not kept up with the UK equities, not kept up with the market? Is it just Brexit, or are there any other risks, let's say, weighing on UK equities?
It's mainly Brexit, and the Brexit risks obviously feed on to economic risks and, in the extreme case, recession. So far, the UK economy has been chugging along reasonably well and hasn't fallen apart. So the real issue, I would say, that Brexit is clearly behind the bulk of the poor sentiment towards the UK. And for me, it's just a case that markets classically overshoot and overreact. So yes, there are risks, certainly higher risks than before Brexit was announced. But we mustn't forget that, you know, 75% of the FTSE 100 for companies' revenues are generated from abroad. And a key contrarian indicator is that the UK and British assets generally are quite hated by asset allocators generally. Mm. So that's often a very good buying signal for the long run. And the FTSE, as I mentioned, has actually rallied very strongly in the last few weeks, actually. So it's 10% less attractive than it was, but there still looks to be some relative value on the table there.
Okay. So other than what looks like perhaps misplaced negative sentiment, why else might UK equities perform well going ahead?
Well, yes, as I mentioned, it's a case of valuations and things overshooting. So many of the UK, let's say domestically slanted stocks in particular, they're priced for very bad news. They've been priced. I've heard one fund manager say they've already had their Brexit based on looking at their share prices. So it's a case of if anything less bad takes place, in theory the shares would have to rise. The expectations are so negative. And as well, if there is a bad outcome, if much of the kind of negative hit has taken place, it might be that the downside's lower than you'd otherwise expect from here. So really it's a case of, you know, fundamentally there are many good companies that are continuing to perform well at fundamental level, but their share prices have been battered, but their fundamental performance and profit generation is looking reasonable. So I think companies are good at adapting. I think they will. So I think, yeah, it's just a case of why the equities might perform well is just because perhaps they've sold down too much.
Okay. Now, do you think any particular types of UK equities are looking particularly attractive?
Yeah, I think domestically, well, the classic Brexit fallout, so anything, any stocks perceived to be a play on the UK domestic economy, they've been particularly hard hit. Some of them are rightly so hard hit. Let's say some of the retailers might face permanent structural challenges, say, from online competition and disruption and so on. But equally, there'll be many good companies that have been, the baby's been thrown out with the bathwater. So I think domestics generally, domestically orientated stocks are looking very cheap, very attractive, but very high risk. So they've almost become classic deep value, if you like. So
is there any particular sector or you know, kind of size of company that, you know, falls under this category?
Well, I think the kind of sell-off has taken place across the board. Mm. But I think some of the mid-cap companies are more more positioned for the domestic side of things. So certainly I think selectively in mid-cap could be quite interesting. I was going to say in terms of sectors, I generally have a preference for managers that like to take an overall approach to hunting out best stocks across various sectors. I don't want to, let's say, put my this sector in particular that, because, you know, I think because the market's sold off quite in a widespread fashion, I think you don't need to stick your neck out on the line too much. I'd say almost avoiding some of the classic expensive bond proxies, and then having a diversified fund with a slight value tilt, doesn't have to be a big value tilt. I think that should be enough to really have a chance of some good outperformance. And if you want to spice it up with a bit of domestic exposure as a kind of smaller, let's say, satellite position in addition to a kind of core, then I think that could work quite well.
What would be some examples of funds which do this?
I think the GLG Undervalued Assets Fund is a very good fund that seeks to, well, as the name suggests, find undervalued shares. And I was quite impressed because I was doing some reading on his fund and reading his newsletters from last summer. And he'd been calling that some of the stocks were way too cheap and looked very good performers, but the stocks had been punished. And he got that spot on, and there's still value there. So I think that's one that looks very good. The fund is trading at 12 times PE ratio and a price to book of 1.4 and a dividend yield of 3.6. So it's a kind of blend. You've got some recovery plays, some special situations, but all are stocks that the manager, Henry Dixon, feels are undervalued by the market in some regard. Another one that's very topical is Neil Woodford's Equity Income Fund. He, roughly a year ago, moved very much into this domestic space, judging that that's where the value lied now, and maybe the classic Woodford churner, good, consistent, steady, defensive stocks got a bit too expensive in part for him, so he found the value in the domestic. So to some extent, that's a good recovery potential. It's a case of if the man following a very tough year or two has proved correct in the end, and many of his stocks do prove to come good. I just feel the real dynamic of this kind of fund is that the upside could be larger than the downside, let's say, albeit a lot of pain has already been taken. And there is a third fund that I think is quite good, a little bit more conservative, if you like, although it's a mid-cap fund. The F&C UK Mid-Cap Fund has something of a capital preservation mindset. They're very cautious on markets generally. They're very selective, and they set high hurdles on what they want to achieve from their companies. So they've been very good historically at consistently outperforming, yet really losing less in market pullbacks. So I think that's one to watch. It's been around 3 years, but it's still quite a small fund. So that's one that potentially could be good if you want some mid-cap exposure, but you don't want to be too hard on the risk, let's say.
Okay. With that in mind, I mean, are these funds only suitable for high-risk investors, or could people with slightly less risk appetite look at them?
I'd certainly say you don't want too much of these, or even very slight, or maybe even none, for lower risk portfolios. I'd say on a kind of medium, typical average risk portfolio, I think maybe you could slot in a very small exposure to let's say one of those funds, or perhaps two. But I'd say certainly for higher risk portfolios, that's where the bulk of these should be, really. If you want a notable exposure to those, they should really be for higher risk portfolios. I'd say for medium risk, a slight nibble is fine, but you just be careful. So, you know, these are very, you know, cheap value stocks that are cheap because there are natural fears. On average, they should do well, but there can be large swings. And yes, I think more for higher risk investors, really.
Great. Thank you, Tim. Some really good suggestions. That brings us to the end of today's show, but you can read more on emerging markets, saving for early retirement, and UK equities in this week's issue of Investors Chronicle and on the website. Thank you for listening, and have a good weekend.
Want your most burning finance and investing questions answered? Here's a podcast you should be listening to, courtesy of Acast Recommends.
Are you ready for some personality in your personal finances? Hi, I'm Janice Torres Rodriguez, Latina money expert and host of the award-winning podcast, Yo Quiero Dinero. On this show, we're serving up POC-friendly personal finance knowledge, always with a side of sass. We're not talking about avocado toast and lattes on this show. We've got real, relatable personal finance knowledge that makes you feel seen, heard, and finally understood. Consider me your super cool, slightly risque, but always honest financial fairy godmother. Together, we'll tackle dinero in a fresh new way so you can finally become poderosa with your dinero. Check out our weekly podcast episodes at YoQuieroDineroPodcast.com or subscribe wherever you listen to podcasts.
Acast helps creators launch, grow, and monetize their podcasts everywhere. Acast.com.